Man, this aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the PBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to white men. I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
Can you please come
the
in?
Point of order.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amra. Thank you so much for tuning in and affording us a bit of your hard-earned data. It will not go to waste, I promise. This week, I'm joined in studio by two of my colleagues, our go-to guy when it comes to all things DA, Apiwa de Klerk, and our star politics reporter, Corinta Hunter. How are you guys doing this week?
All good? So what's with the compliments?
I'm in a good mood this week, So this week we're talking about former President Jacob Zuma's son, Dudu Zwane, and his testimony, and I say that with like air quotes, at the state capture inquiry. We're also talking about a surprise announcement by former DEA national leader Helen Ziller that she has made herself available for the position of federal council chairperson of the Blue Party. We'll explore what this means for the DEA should she get the post, and what it means for Maimane as the party's leader. So let's get straight into it, guys. Let's start off with Helen Ziller. So if Ziller wins the position of federal council chairperson, which is currently James Self's position, right, Apiwe?
Yeah.
It would put her in charge of the DA's day-to-day affairs, sort of like, if I'm not mistaken here, like a secretary general for the ANC, right?
Yes, something similar.
Now, Times Live reported earlier this week that Ziller's unexpected announcement comes as the DA is embroiled in an ugly public splat. With top MPs taking party leader Musi Maimane to task after revelations over his rented Cape Town home and that he had been using a vehicle donated by former Steinhoff CEO Marcus Huster. Now, is there more to this whole move by Ziller than just the revelations against Maimane?
First of all, it was a surprising move that she made herself available. Some would have expected her to endorse a candidate.
Yeah.
You know, that's what former party leaders do anyway. That she's running herself is quite interesting. Mm. And it's also quite interesting that she will be, for the third time, going head-to-head with the former mayor of Nelson Mandela Bay,
Athol
Trollip. When she won, initially she was contesting against him. Mm. She defeated Athol Trollip again in a parliamentary election, even though it wasn't her who was running, but it was Lindiwe Mazibuko. But we all knew and understood that it was her candidate. So it's going to be an interesting contest. And it's going to be a test of how much influence she still really have within the DA.
So break it down for us here. So it's she's running mostly against, or her strongest competitor now is Athol Trollip. Is anybody else contending for the position?
There is Thomas Walters and Mike Walters. Now, Mike Walters has been the face of the resistance against Musi, or rather the face of the people who have been taking Musi to task, especially on the two issues regarding his rented home in Cape Town and that Toyota Fortune from Steinhoff. So it's not a surprise that Mike Waters would have entered the race. He's been in that faction, so yeah, it's not a surprise for him.
Just to break it down a bit more basically, if we look at the factions of the DA, Helen Ziller falls on whose side? Musi's side or his opposing?
Definitely the opposing side. Athol, we understand, is a Musi guy.
Mm.
Has been ever since Musi ascended to that position. They've had that sort of a relationship for quite a while. So yeah.
So, Apiwa, you remember that press conference where Helen Ziller decided to step down as party leader?
Yes.
And it was after the 2014 drama with trying to get a black face of the party's presidential candidate, Mampela Ramphele.
Mampela Ramphele, yes.
And at the time, so during the Mampela Ramphele scandal, Helen Zille's kind of psyche or what prompted her to do that was that she needed to grow the party to so that it could, reach out of its traditional stronghold and then effectively attract the black voter.
Mm-hmm.
And so that day when she resigned and endorsed Musi Maimane as her successor, it was seen as, okay, I'm done with active politics. I did my bit for the party. Now mm-hmm. we need to get people who are going to. And at the time, both Lindiwe Maziboko, Musi Maimane, even you could even say at the time she was fighting, what is the youth league, Mbali Ntuli, they were all told by critics, some people in the media, that this is puppeteering, that Helen Zille is putting a black face because it suits her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Musi, your Pumzila van Dams, who was a staffer in the DA and then propelled up at the time, they took offense to it because they said that, it takes away your agency. And people, the more people said you are a puppet, the more they resisted it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now when I look 5 years later or more, and you see that, first of all, Helen Zille saying it was a mistake to have done that, meaning she felt that she made these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now that she's sort of coming back into the party after being party leader and stepping down because she was done, and you know, she's done in public service as well, for me that shows that it's Helen Zille taking her party back from the blacks.
When we were working on that story for Sunday about the fact that Musi must resign and not avail himself again for that position if the party goes to an early congress, a lot of people and even readers reacted to say the whites are taking back their party. So I don't know if we would want to read that together.
But why would you be a party? Why would you be a party leader, be a whole premier? Now you have to step down constitutionally as premier, and you gave up your position as because you're saying that's all I could have done for the party. That's what she said. This is all. So your return to active politics must be only motivated by the fact that the people that are currently there are messing up.
That you think that those people are not capable.
Exactly.
But you must also remember the pressure that led to her resigning at the time. It also had to do with Athol Trollip, realistically, because some of her former allies or her allies at the time felt that she needed to go. And they brought Athol Trollip to contest for the current position that he holds.
Mm.
So for her, at the time, she didn't take it in. She felt that if you have Athol Trollip, a white man, you have James Self, a white man, and now you will have her, a white woman. It then meant everything that the opponents of the DA are saying about it being a white party would then actually, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on to say, no, actually, we are not a white party, because the three most senior positions would have been most senior, most important would be held by white people, basically. The Athol Trollip position currently, and it's not that powerful, but it.
What position is that?
He's the chairperson. The position that he currently holds, it doesn't have that much power to such an extent that some people are motivating for it to be removed, to be made redundant after this contest, which is coming later. Sorry, this month.
When is this vote going to take place?
During the Federal Council meeting.
Okay, and what would it mean, essentially, what would you predict would happen if Zille had to get this position? What would it mean for Musi as leader of the party then?
So a number of people who had been analysing this were saying that, look, her coming back now, it's she will keep Musi Maimane in check for the remainder of the period up until the the upcoming conference, or rather up until the next conference. So she would ensure that she sort of prepares a ground for a candidate that she would endorse or would prefer over Musi. Their relationship was basically non-existent after after that fallout over the tweet. You would hear Musi in public even saying, but I spoke with her when she was premier, but when she's no longer premier, there's nothing basically to talk about. So it shows you that relationship was non-existent, basically.
So we could liken it to sort of Ramaphosa as president of the ANC and having an ace in his top six, sort of thing.
Basically. Yeah. It will be quite difficult, because you must remember the person that they are running to replace James Self. James Self, for a lot of people had been crediting him for being a level-headed person, a person who brings the respectability to that position, a person who you wouldn't see in public spats, even when there's a crisis, how he used to comment on the news of the day about infighting he was sort of a mediator of some sort. So both Athol and Helen Zille are quite strong characters. It's going to be very interesting to see how they go about when they take over, or whoever takes over from there. But if Athol takes over, this would be a boost to Musi Maimane and his control of the party. You know, when he backs a candidate,
he gets it done.
He gets things done.
But you see, all of this internal shenanigans within the DA can't be seen in isolation. The DA, from even before the elections, has been in a quagmire, and speaks to the bad state of the opposition in South Africa. You have dozens of smaller, irrelevant authoritarian parties. You have the EFF, which is authoritative, and then you have the DA, which is in shambles. And this doesn't bode well for democracy.
Of course,
and if you look at the India example, as I was speaking to a journalist from there recently, and she was saying that there's a rise in fascism that in India, and the, you know, sort of the erosion of democracy under the Modi government there is largely attributed to the fact that the opposition, which is the Congress Party, which is what the ANC was in alliance with, is like in shambles. People don't care, you know, that kind of thing. It's all about positioning it. And so sometimes we have to step out of the bubble of maybe thinking this is about Helen Zille, or this is about Athol Trollope or Musi Maimane, but also thinking about you know, the state of opposition, which brings me to the Institute for Race Relations and the effort to save the opposition, because that is the biggest BS I've seen in my entire life. So I understand the concern that, yes, there's a problem. The opposition in South Africa is in shambles, and this doesn't really matter on a parliamentary scale. This matters in the Msunduzi municipality. This matters in, that's where it matters, when the opposition is in so much of crisis that where it ought to hit, especially where it affects at the core face of people on local government level, on provincial government level. I mean, think about you know, provincial governments. You haven't heard the DA make noise in the different provinces as they used to, and that's because of these kind of internal dynamics. But the IRR is being opportunistic. Apu is smiling because those are his friends.
Look, I personally think it is good for the DA to go through this phase. ANC has gone through similar phases, and it has proven that it can survive. The reasons behind their loss in votes can be attributed to they are infighting, which is the ANC. But it's mostly because of the track record in government. Now, the DA, on the other hand, has not gone through such a phase. It's the first time that they've lost votes. It's the first time they see such contests very far from a Congress. When they held their Congress where Musi was not contested, where James Self was not contested, it seemed as if all is well. But not really. Their biggest fights have got to do with how they want the DA to, which direction they want the DA to take.
The diversity clause.
The diversity clause, the issue of BEE and whatnot. So these are fights that were there leading up to the Congress. But, you know, sometimes these contests are lost and won when there is a face to contest, you see. So when two people who claim to be representing either this side or the other side are actually in contest, you never saw Mike Waters contesting face to or rather head on with Amosi Maimane and him championing that the DA needs to go back to its classical liberal roots, or Amosi Maimane saying, I am this candidate and this is what I stand for. I want the diversity clause. This is what we stand for in the BE. So you didn't have a win or a lose. You had positions or a position the party adopting based on the fact that the majority had supported Moose.
Well, it's going to be an interesting run-up, but let's take a very quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about Dudazone Zuma at the State Capture Inquiry. Join us when we're back.
Racial identity politics, a phrase that has the potential to start an argument in just about any situation. That's why we're starting it first. Let's Start an Argument is a unique and insightful podcast series about the meaning of race to us today. Presented by researcher Cecilia Koch and Doctor of Philosophy Jason Werbeloff, the series aims to spark rational argument and meaningful discussion around this controversial topic. Find Let's Start an Argument now on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember, if you want to advertise on this podcast, you can email smiths at tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths at tisoblackstar.co.za. Cool, let's get straight back into it now. So Zuma Jr. fielded questions on Monday on a range of allegations set out before the commission by people like former Deputy Finance Minister Tabisi Jonas, former Free State Economic Development MEC Nolisi Dukwana, ANN7's former editor Rajesh Sundaram, former KZN Hawks boss Johan Boysen, and former Cabinet Minister Nkwakuo Ramoslodi. So there were a lot of allegations sort of leveled against him at the State Capture Inquiry prior to his appearance here this week. Now, much of his appearance on Monday related to Jonas' allegations. Now, Jonas said previously that he was taken from the Hyatt Hotel in Rosebank on December 23rd, 2015, by Zuma to the nearby Gupta compound in Sachsenwald. Now, the meeting was conducted, now this is according to what Jonas said, he said he didn't know where he was going when he got into the vehicle with Zuma, but the meeting was conducted under the impression that Jonas was meeting with Zuma and ANC member Fana Shlongwane to discuss rumors that Shlongwane was blackmailing Jonas. So why it's important is because it was at this meeting that Jonas was allegedly offered the job as finance minister, plus a 600 million rand bribe by the Gupta family in exchange for doing the family's bidding once he took office. Now, I remember Dudazone Zuma did concede that he arranged the meeting between Jonas and Shlongwane, who themselves are old friends, and drove Jonas to the Gupta compound. But he said that Jonas knew exactly where he was going. He also denied that any bribery took place at the meeting and that it only focused on the bribery rumor between Shlongwane and Jonas. Okay, what do you make of Dudazone's explanation here?
It's bogus. bogus. You see what's happening now, right? And this is the thing about the State Capture Commission, is that it has given rogues time to come up with
stories,
and also to get the best legal defense in terms to in an effort to create an argument that is sustained.
Yeah.
Because the reality of it is, if it's Jonas's word against three other people's word, and all three of them are saying, no, we never talk about this, obviously it's whose word against who now.
Exactly.
And there was no one else in the meeting. So that's why it's interesting to see what they're admitting to and what they're denying. Because in the past, that Oak Bay statement, as you know, denied the entire thing. And I remember writing the story, my former colleague, Tanutkolo Jiga, reminded us yesterday that, you know, when we wrote the story, when we broke the story in 2016, in March 2016, over three years ago, the ANC had said, it's gossip masquerading as news, and it's lies masquerading as news. Because at the time, they went on the word of Duduzani and the Guptas and said, no, there was no such thing.
Mm.
Now, the criticism that comes out, or the defense almost that Duduzani would want to have, is that, why did a whole deputy minister get into a car if he didn't know where he was going? It happens all the time. You trust this guy. This guy is a comrade. You know the guy.
It's also the president's son.
Yeah, the president's son. You get into, you know, you're probably friendly with him. You know, you probably know common people. You want to have a meeting. And the thing is, Jonas is the type of person, you know, when he was deputy minister, was you know, a maverick in the sense that he would meet people, he'd go on his own. So that's an irrelevant discussion. The problem is, and you saw the size of Duduzani's legal team.
Damn,
and
yeah.
And you're
talking about people like Pete Lowe, like Mike Helens. Guys don't come cheap.
And it's about seven or eight of them?
There's about eight of them, yeah.
Yeah. So they realized, okay. What we need to do is we need to put a spanner in this bribery, because that's going to send us to jail. Everything else, I'm not going to send no one to jail.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that you took Mkabisi Jonas to a meeting that you discussed, all of that is irrelevant. What is going to send those who are implicated to jail, if we have a functioning criminal justice system, which we don't have, sorry, Advocate Fatoui, is the fact that that there was an exchange, there was a solicitation involved, and that really is the issue. And also, if you remember, when Jonas wanted to add that into his affidavit to the Hawks, he was prompted by corrupt individuals in the Hawks to remove that kind of sentiment, because they know that actually is a crime, and you would have to arrest Duduzani and the Gupta brothers on that charge.
If I remember correctly, during his testimony,
Jonas,
it seemed as if the offer was made between him and the brother, and that probably some people would not have really had the entire conversation, wasn't it?
Yes, but the problem is, if you were the person that facilitated that meeting, so if you it's the same like if you facilitated the drug, you know, the exchange of drugs, you know, you can still be implicated in something.
I get that, and it should be. My questioning is, how does he confidently deny the offer being made? When Jonas' version, when he came here, he explained it to the point where I think at some point he even said he is not sure that the people at the background
could hear. Yeah, yeah.
So on what grounds is he then going under oath?
Well, he's essentially saying that it never happened at all. So they did was they went to the house, they were alone. It was Shlongwane, Jonas, and him, Zuma, who were present, who were sitting in the lounge. They had their meeting about these rumors. Rajesh Gupta apparently popped his head through the door, like, listen, I need to ask you about some meeting about tomorrow. Are you available? He sold that to Zuma, and then he left. So what Duduzani is saying is that, what are you talking about? Rajesh Gupta, or one of the Gupta brothers, never spoke to Mkabisi Jonas at all. That's his defense. But this is the interesting part, and this is what Kwanita was saying as well. I was looking at the guy's demeanor. Like, he was so confident and cocksure, just like his father was when he came here. And I think I would be the same, because if I knew that there was no concrete evidence against me, I mean, all the commission has on Duduzani so far, and they haven't looked at the Gupta leaks. I mean, that's not part of their domain. They're looking at what has been presented to the commission by witnesses so far. All they have is that he's facilitated meetings between state officials and politicians with the Gupta family, that he's taken them to the Gupta household for whatever reasons. Mm. Now, what it then becomes is it's a your word against my situation. Mm. And then what do? You're obviously going to be confident.
At best, the Zondo Commission is going to say in its report that Duduzane played a middleman role. But middleman roles are not going to send you to jail.
Yeah.
So you are confident. And you know what we forget? Really what we forget is that this commission doesn't scare anyone, because the people who were involved in state capture know how much they captured the criminal justice system. They are walking around superbly confident. And, you know, to take it, back a little bit, despite the fact that we had so many people implicate former President Jacob Zuma, they're walking around saying, no, there was no corruption, despite the fact that there was evidence under oath that he would get money in bags once a month.
Yeah. Well, there's the other argument here, is that the Frieda Dairy Farm and the Estida project. I mean, there was so much done in terms of investigating by the media. They basically gave the Hawks all the information they needed, and the investigators still couldn't put a case together that it was thrown out of court.
And that's a simple, that is such a simple case. Simplest form of and also, when it was thrown out of court, that wasn't even a prosecution.
Yeah.
That was a forfeiture application. And
exactly.
You know, forfeiture applications are like the easiest thing to do. You just need to show proceeds of crime and you're good to go.
Yeah.
So, the reality of it is, I mean, I don't know how you manage. I mean, I was covering the State Capture Commission just prior to you taking over in the initial phase of it. And obviously, a lot of what has been reported is what is coming before the commission is what, you know, we reported previously. But you almost at a point now where it's like this is, you're tempted to say this is just clowning. This is really because the reality of it is if you don't have a political establishment that is committed to rooting this out, and you don't have a proper reform of the criminal justice system, and I sound like a broken, I am a broken record when I say this. I say it over and over and over again. Because the reality of it is that the State Capture Commission, at best, is going to be used as a political, that's the best, the best case scenario is that it's going to be used as a political football in the ANC, where some people are going to be purged out as a result of the outcomes of the State Capture Commission. That's the best case scenario.
You know, for me, I was thinking about it this morning, and for me, I think in terms of information or new information that has come out of the State Capture Inquiry, 20% of what I've heard so far is stuff that I've for the first time heard. But 80% of stuff is just a regurgitation of what we've already been reporting on for the past 10 years, almost 10 years. So like, you've got to ask yourself, why are we spending this sort of money on sort of getting some people to tell us what we already know, where this money could have been used to launch proper investigations into these people.
And you know, the thing is, what really is, and I suppose I think a lot of people have been irked by Duduzane's demeanor. And I mean, he's a cocky, arrogant guy. He had the same demeanor in his culpable homicide case, which he again won because he has a very good legal team and access to resources. The reality of it is, the people who were instrumental in capturing the state knew or put in mechanisms in place for when they got caught. So in so many of these instances, there is an alibi for almost everything.
And there's also no paper trails. Nobody ever put their name down on a piece of paper and signed off on any documents. That's clear in the Frieda thing, where they got almost like political lackeys or lackeys in the department to sign off on things, rather than the heads of the departments actually making any big moves. So there's no paper trail, there's no evidence linking them there besides what we can now call just sort of hearsay or first-hand testimony.
Yeah, and it's scary that after so much resources, a lot of people seems like they're going to walk scot-free. It's similar to what had happened to the Arms Deal Commission.
Or Marikana.
Similar to the Marikana Commission. It seems there's no appetite to go after people who have done wrong. No one can give you a credible explanation why no one has been charged in Marikana.
Yeah.
No one.
Mm.
Absolutely no one. But we every time we say we remember miners who were shot, dead on live TV. But that's where it ends. I fear a similar situation.
You know, I have so little faith, because if you look at people who come to the commission and give hard evidence where somebody like Colonel Dhananjaya Naidu or Colonel Kobus Rulofsa from the Hawks, who've come here and said, look, these are the investigations we've done. Here's the information we have. We've dug up all this dirt. Here is the paper trail. Here are the documents. Here is everything we have. We just need 1, 2, and 3 to prosecute. And these investigations have been running, this is into Richard Mdluli and the Secret Service account, been running for like 6 years, but they can't get crime intelligence to declassify documents. So if something as simple as that can't have gone to successful prosecution, how are we going to manage these massive allegations of state capture?
And you know, the thing is, right, the excitement when Cyril Ramaphosa came in is that there was going to be a reform of the criminal justice system. And they thought, okay, let's just put someone credible on the top, and then it is what it is. Mm. But I mean, really, we need to start asking these questions, to be like, how is it that you're not charging people for even small things?
Mm.
You know, that there's so much of evidence. You know, if you talk about VBS,
mm.
if you talk about, I mean, those things, investigations have already been
exactly.
done. And so the thing is, someone was cautioning me to say, as journalists, we have a bigger responsibility not to make the public disillusioned in institutions like the State Capture Commission, because these play very important roles. And we're not taking away from the work of the commission. They're obviously doing important work, and they're not wasting their time. They know it's Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Sondo. But the reality of it is that you're telling people to be patient because the Zondo Commission is going to solve the problem.
Mm.
But I can tell you, you can tell me, anyone can tell you, that it's going to solve nothing. What at the best case scenario is going to formally tell us what's actually the problem.
Exactly.
Like, think about the Mokoro inquiry, right? The Mokoro inquiry into the two top prosecutors, Nomsobo Jiba and Lawrence Mukwebe. It was a rigorous process. The report came out. We reported on the report. It was, you know, fiery letters by Ramaphosa to say, you lied to me, therefore you are fired, right? What is Juba doing now? Taking the matter to court.
Exactly.
It's going to play out, hoping the political wheel will turn, may have some allies in parliament. You understand?
Exactly. And that was such a small commission that focused on two people. Now you've got a commission that's already had at least 300-400 witnesses that I've come across. So the magnitude of that is going to be on a whole different scale.
Mm.
And I feel personally that once this is done, it's going to, exactly as you said, it's going to tell us what we already know, and then it's going to be used as maybe a political sort of game changer to be like, look, now this report says you've done wrongdoing, so therefore I need to get rid of you. So maybe it's going to be used that way. We're just going to have to wait and see, I guess.
But I mean, the Marikana Commission was not even used that way, so you can't even hold your breath.
Anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you guys for joining me in studio. Really appreciate it. We'll be back same time next week. Take care.